Tucker.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. She's heir to a political dynasty. Her husband remains imprisoned in Pakistan. She faces corruption charges there and lives in self-imposed exile in England and Dubai. One of the most dramatic political leaders in the Muslim world, Benazir Bhutto, talks with us this hour about the U.S.-led war on terror and her bid for re-election in Pakistan next fall. First, new developments in the growing rift between India and Pakistan. Today, India recalled its top diplomat in Islamabad. Joining us is Rama Lakshmi, special correspondent with The Washington Post in New Delhi. Rama Lakshmi, why is India recalling its high commissioner from Pakistan?
You have to look at it. Look at what happened last Thursday. The Indian Parliament was attacked by five armed gunmen. You know, they came with bombs and grenades and guns, and they entered the grounds of Parliament. This is unprecedented. It's never happened. India really reacted angrily. Ever since, every day, relations between the two countries have worsened every day. New war of words, new escalation of rhetoric. India telling Pakistan to act against the two terrorist groups, Jaish-e-Mohammed and Lashkar-e-Taiba, which India blames for the attack on Parliament. Pakistan saying, no, you stage managed it yourself. We don't approve of your investigation. So it's gotten worse. And yesterday, Indian Prime Minister said, I'm not going to meet Pakistani president in Nepal at a South Asian regional summit. So it's gotten worse. And this was kind of expected. And also, there's a whole lot of pressure, public opinion on the government to do something, to act now. Because every time something like this happens, Indian government just reacts and talks stuff, but doesn't do anything. So,
and it's not just diplomatic ties, Rama Lakshmi. Railway ties have been cut as well. We hear talk about the disruption of rail and bus services between the two countries. Is there any precedent for this?
Well, the railway service, this is a train called Samjhota Express. Samjhota in Hindi actually means an agreement, ironically. Mm-hmm. This was started in 1975, and yes, there has been a precedent for this, because in 1984 and 1992, following widespread riots in India, the railways of this particular express was discontinued, but it was restarted. But the bus service, the Lahore bus service, this is kind of historic, and this was a project that was initiated by the Prime Minister Vajpayee, Atal Bihari Vajpayee, in 1999, when he actually rode the bus and he went to Lahore to meet the then Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, and he signed this great Lahore Declaration of Friendship and how they will work together against terrorism and how to address other smaller issues and reduce the tension. So the stopping of the bus service is really a huge setback, because this brought in a lot of people-to-people contacts. Mm-hmm. Common people could go back and forth the border, and people with links in both the countries, one foot here and another family there. It helped them an enormous deal.
Rama Lakshmi, India's Prime Minister Vajpayee says India has all the proof it needs to link Pakistan-based terrorists to the attack on the parliament in New Delhi. What is the evidence?
Well, they have carried out some arrests. They have arrested about 10 people, and they have got confessions out of these people. One of them was on television yesterday. It was very carefully planned media exposure by the Delhi police, really. This man comes out and says, I was the main facilitator, I belong to Jaish, and these five men who were killed in the attack, who entered parliament, they were Pakistani, and they came here because they thought the struggle in Kashmir had to be brought to Delhi, and I facilitated them. I gave them logistical support. I did this for money. I did this for jihad.
Mm-hmm.
They have these confessions and some telephone calls made from here the previous night, the night before the attack, to their families back in Pakistan.
But it's all linked to the Kashmiri separatist movement, they say.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
So
that's what they claim.
Give us a sense of the political and public pressure inside India right now. There have been very tense relations between these countries before. They're, of course, both nuclear powers. How severe is this? We even hear the word war kind of flitting around the edges of this conversation. What's your estimate?
Yes, we are hearing the word war, but so far it's been really on the level of rhetoric. But yes, we have to take this kind of seriously because there have been troop deployments. A whole lot of trains have been put on service to ferry troops. Annual leave of soldiers have been cancelled. Passengers moving towards border towns, they don't get tickets anymore because those trains are moving soldiers. So there's all this happening on both sides of the border. So there is a fear, and India has approached this kind of a level several times, this nervous level several times. The Indian government calls it the hot pursuit line, where they think they will send the troops out and bomb or strike at terrorist training camps on the other side of the border. But it's not as simple as that, because both of us are nuclear nations, and any such thing can actually have a nuclear fallout. And camps, if you bomb a camp here, tomorrow another camp can spring up somewhere else. And so India is very aware also of the limitations of such military options.
Do you see any connection between this heightened tension and these attacks and the recent military actions in Afghanistan?
Yes, I think in a way India feels that if United States can do it, we can too. If terrorism is on the global agenda now, we have been suffering as victims of terrorism for the past 15 years. So it feels kind of emboldened because of what happened in Afghanistan.
Rama Lakshmi, let me ask you quickly a tangential question. We're talking this hour with Benazir Bhutto. How significant a political figure is she seen from the perspective of Delhi? She's talking about a run for leadership of Pakistan again next fall. Does she figure into the equation there?
Well, India has always wanted a democratic Pakistan. So in that, she's looked at as a figure of democracy. She came in through India last month, and she gave a speech where she condemned the terrorism in the United States. She condemned Taliban. She condemned the jihadi groups in Pakistan. She condemned Musharraf. All this was, pleasant to Indian ears. Of course, they also think when she was the prime minister herself, there wasn't much of a difference because India accuses that government to actually heighten the whole campaign on Kashmir. So, yes, democracy, to turn to democracy, India favors. Yes, she made all the right noises in India, but India doesn't really trust anybody in Pakistan at the end of the day, whether it's a general or a democratically elected leader.
Rama Lakshmi, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Rama Lakshmi is a special correspondent with The Washington Post in New Delhi. It's a long time since Benazir Bhutto was a student at Harvard. It's 13 years since she was first elected Prime Minister of Pakistan, and 5 years since she lost the post amid corruption charges. Benazir Bhutto is 48 now, still a vibrant, connected voice. Her children are 8, 11, and 13. She and they have not seen her husband, their father, in 2.5 years. Asif Ali Zardari is in a Pakistani prison on related charges. Benazir Bhutto describes the charges as persecution. Since September 11th, she's been voicing her hope for a stable, democratic Pakistan and will be running for re-election next fall. I spoke with Benazir Bhutto earlier this week. She served as Prime Minister of Pakistan from 1988 to 1990 and again from 1993 to 1996. She is chairperson of the Pakistan People's Party. I started our conversation asking her view of the American response to the attacks of September 11th.
It was a terrible crime that was committed against the United States, but also it was a crime against humanity. It was expected that the United States would respond, and it's good that it has responded because focus is now on the threat to terrorism. My country, Pakistan, is one of the few countries in the world where there are apprehensions amongst the population that terrorism could build up. So personally, I'm very happy to see that the issues of terrorism are now being dealt with.
Benazir Bhutto, you witnessed the rise of Islamic fundamentalism and even Islamic violence firsthand for years. Were you surprised on September 11th? Was this beyond what you'd expected, or did you fear something like this might come eventually to pass?
I was surprised at the scale of the attack that took place. I never imagined that there could be an attack that could take on the most powerful symbols of finance and military might in the most powerful country of the world. I did expect there to be attack, but on a smaller scale. I was shocked when I watched the aeroplane go inside the Twin Towers. And I also had an awful feeling as I watched it that it had to do with my part of the world.
You know the United States well from your time in university here and many visits, and of course you know the Pakistan-Afghanistan region of the world well. What did you think of the American reaction at an emotional level that you saw from abroad? And also talk to us about the emotional reaction in Pakistan, where there were very mixed feelings in response to 9/11, as far as we could tell.
Well, in a sense, I think that American people are very innocent. They are Americans, I find, are cut off from the rest of the world by oceans, and they are very much into their own society and humanity. They do understand that there should be peace and security. But because America has not really been attacked since Pearl Harbor, there is an innocence in America.
And when you say innocence, you mean a kind of naivete, really?
Not naivete,
mm-hmm.
but a kind of innocence about war or conflict or bloodshed. For
mm-hmm.
example, my country has had three wars.
Mm-hmm.
So my country and my people know what war is about. But people in America were innocent to conflicts, and I think that it is that innocence that has been shattered. And that is what I feel saddest about, that people have a right to see the world through the eyes of innocence, and snatching away that innocence with this terrible attack hit me profoundly.
Mm. And the response of Pakistanis, who history has not permitted such an innocent view of the world, many Americans were struck by the images of anti-American sentiment in the streets of Pakistan this fall.
Yes, there were demonstrations in Pakistan. And my country is very much a reflection of many other Muslim countries where public opinion is divided between the religious militants and their promises to take us back to a past glory. And between modernizers who say that respect and dignity lies in joining the world community, in learning and education and adapting to technology. So I think that when this attack took place, opinion was divided. But I do feel that the vast majority did think that what had been done was wrong, and they understood there had to be a reaction. And as far as my party was concerned, we were pleased to see Islamabad join the international coalition against Dera.
Benazir Bhutto, President Bush has said that he wants Osama bin Laden dead or alive. What do you think is required to bring Osama bin Laden to justice?
It's going to be a very challenging task. After all, we are talking about looking for one man in a sea of humanity. For me, this is less of a war, or one could say it's a kind of criminal investigation, but it has warlike characteristics too. Maybe this is what war is going to look like in the 21st century. I think eventually Osama bin Laden will be tracked down. It's going to be difficult for him to hide. It's going to be difficult for him not to contact people who are part of his family or friends or organization. But I think that it might take some time.
Are you personally persuaded of bin Laden's guilt in the 9/11 attacks?
Well, I'm not a judge, so I can't really say what a jury would decide. But when I saw this attack took place, my immediate thought went to my part of the world, and I felt that these are the same people who did the first World Trade Center bombing and the first attack on the, I think, the CIA headquarters
mm-hmm.
in Langley, which
mm-hmm.
took place in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, the American television was saying, we must not jump to conclusions and we must wait. But my own instinct was that it had the signature of the same people. But I'm not a judge.
We're talking with Benazir Bhutto, the former Prime Minister of Pakistan from 1987 to 1990 and again from 1993 to 1996. She's chairperson of the Pakistan People's Party, and she's contemplating a new run for the leadership position at the top of the Pakistani political system. We're going to be talking more after a short break. We're not taking calls tonight, but you can join the conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. From WBUR Boston, this is Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight with Benazir Bhutto, former Prime Minister of Pakistan. Benazir Bhutto, we were chatting a bit before the break about Osama bin Laden, and I'd love to get some more of your thoughts about this man. He was not much known or talked about in the United States before this fall. There had been some reports, but he's become an enormous presence in the American consciousness in the fall of 2001. What do you know of Osama bin Laden personally, and describe for us, if you will, his appeal in the Islamic world?
Well, I first heard of Osama bin Laden in 1989, long before he achieved international notoriety with the criminal acts. I was then the Prime Minister of Pakistan, and I heard that there was a move to topple my government by extremist forces, and that there was a man called bin Laden who had contributed $10 million to buy the sympathies of my supporters in Parliament and have my government thrown out through a no-confidence vote. And I just wondered, why would this man want to spend $10 million in my country to overthrow my government? And I was told, well, he's fought the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. He is an Islamic militant, and he is opposed to the government of a woman. That's how I first heard of him. That was in 1989.
Mm-hmm.
But later on, I thought that he was opposed to me partially because I was a woman, but he was also opposed to me because Pakistan neighbors Afghanistan. So Pakistan is the jugular vein of Afghanistan. And while I was Prime Minister of Pakistan and my party had control of the writ of state, it was very difficult for terrorists to come into Pakistan or to leave Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
That's why if you look at the terrorist attacks that have taken place against America, the bombings in Yemen, and, of course, the bombings in New York and the Pentagon, and even in India, New Delhi and Bombay, they took place when I was not Prime Minister of Pakistan. So I think that the terrorists are frightened of having a moderate and democratic government in the country, because then the power is not centralized with a few groups. Power is decentralized, and there is a stronger grip over who looks after the rule of law. There is the rule of law. So there's great strictness on immigration, emigration, customs, import of weapons, export of people.
We want to talk about Pakistan's political situation, and will, but give us a little more insight into bin Laden, if you would. How do you account for his seeming popularity in much of the Islamic world?
This is a very challenging question because there are different reasons. Different areas in the Muslim world have different conflicts. And bin Laden has been able to somehow peg his own message onto these different conflicts. For example, he'll talk about the Kashmiris, which will appeal to the people of Pakistan and to the Muslims of South Asia. Or he'll talk about the Palestinian issue, which will have a greater appeal in the Middle East. And he will then talk about Chechnya so that he can appeal to Muslims who are living in Central Asia. He pegged his argument onto different regional conflict, although I think that his main goal is to try and seize control of Saudi Arabia, he doesn't say that so much.
Mm-hmm.
So really, his appeal lies in talking to aggrieved and afflicted groups that are born of regional conflict.
Is he personally appealing? He's often on Al Jazeera, the satellite television network around the Middle East. Is his demeanor, his language, his mannerisms, is he charismatic in that way? We're told he is.
Well, he's not charismatic to me, but I think that he has more charisma to the people who live in the Arab world, because first of all, he's an Arab, and second of all, there is a more conservative interpretation of Islam within the Arab world itself. In Pakistan, the large majority of the people, of course, are non-Arab, and they also belong to a different religious school. The Hanafi school is the school that most Pakistanis belong to. So he lacks the ethnic or sectarian appeal in Pakistan that he can have in the Arab world.
Benazir Bhutto, step way back with us, looking at the Middle East and the Islamic world, I guess, as centered there. There now seems to be a great contest going on for the hearts and minds of people in that part of the world. The Islamic militants have made a big run at gaining popularity and have succeeded in no small measure. There's a lot of anti-American sentiment. There's dissatisfaction with governments in Saudi Arabia and Egypt and elsewhere. Where is this region heading? What does it need to get to a more stable situation?
I think the Muslim countries need to have a look at the political structures that are in place. Many of these political structures were put in motion when the countries gained independence, and now some of them are becoming outdated. You mentioned about the anti-Americanism. Well, there are people who shout anti-American slogans, but at the same time, they wear blue jeans, they drink Coca-Cola, and they love to eat hamburgers. So it's a very strange sort of love-hate relationship where people love the American way of life but seem to resent America for not being able to give them the freedoms that most Americans can enjoy.
What about exactly that, beyond blue jeans and hamburgers? What about American values, freedom and liberty? I think there's confusion in the United States about whether those would actually be welcome values in the Islamic world.
Well, this is a catch-22 situation. Because most of the Islamic world has non-democratic governments, but their people want freedom. And in a sense, they feel that they are outside decision-making and there's a lack of accountability and there's a lack of transparency. But because there's been a non-democratic culture that has come into being, there are very few democratic alternatives. Mm-hmm. And the alternatives are really the clerics or the clerical-backed movements. So we are in a very difficult situation. I am arguing that the Muslim world must be given a third choice, that is a democratic choice. But right now, most countries have a choice between a Western-backed dictator and between a clerical-backed dictator or dictatorship.
But
and that's a wrong choice.
But in that case, if the United States were indeed to shift its policy and to push for freedom, liberty, democracy in these countries, as opposed to the autocracies it's often been associated with, would it end up with democracies or would it end up with Islamic states that were anti-American and radically devoted to that path?
Right now, I think there are quite a few countries, not Pakistan, because we've had our own democratic culture and we've got democratic parties. But in countries that have not had a democratic culture for 50 years, I think that a sudden return to democracy could find us facing a situation where there are anti-Western parties that initially grabbed power. For example, in Algeria, when elections were held, the Islamists won. So I think I would argue that there's a need to evolve towards greater freedoms and democratization. There's a need to let go of some of the state power so that we can make the transition from autocracies to democracies.
How can the United States effectively support that transition without toppling the apple cart in a way that ends up hurting many people?
Well, this is in the interest of the Muslim countries, too. In a sense, there was an author that wrote that in the past, when Oxford and Harvard University were functioning in England and America, there were very famous Muslim universities, too. And individual thought and creativity has died down because there's very little freedom of expression. So in a sense, the Muslim societies themselves are threatened with being undermined unless they can move on the path of freedom. This means that there can be a dialogue between the West, which should encourage autocracies to open up their societies gradually in an absorbable and sustainable fashion.
You yourself, we understand, are planning a return to political life. If we understand correctly, you're preparing for another run to be Prime Minister of Pakistan again at the head of your Pakistan People's Party. The United States has grown close this fall to the military leader of Pakistan, Pervez Musharraf. Elections are scheduled for next October. Will you seek to be Prime Minister again? And do you believe that there will be free and fair elections in Pakistan in a time of so much tension in that region?
I would like to run for Prime Minister of Pakistan again because I feel that my party has the popular support. We have a team and we have an experience and we have a vision that can help build peace in the region, help stabilize the government, the new government in Afghanistan, as well as de-escalate tensions with India. I know many in the United States have a sense of gratitude to General Musharraf for having delivered by joining the International Coalition Against Terror. But on the other hand, he must be a factor for political stability. I'm afraid he's been unable to really build relationships with India. We are again at a point where both countries are in a state of grave tension. And he's been unable to really build a rapport with the dominant forces in the new Afghan government. I would like to see the United States encourage General Musharraf to share the political space with other political players and insist on a fair election, because I think the best guarantee for American and Western security is a secure and stable Pakistan and a secure South Asia. And that means democracy and fair elections.
General Musharraf has not been subtle about his contempt for political actors in Pakistan, including yourself and your oftentime rival Nawaz Sharif. He's decreed that he'll remain president even after the elections. What would that mean? Could Pakistan have an elected prime minister and a president, or is he saying there's no room for a new prime minister?
I think he's saying there's no room for a new prime minister. As far as I'm concerned, I really want to see fair elections. If General Musharraf were to come and visit me tomorrow and said, Benazir Bhutto, I want fair elections. I'm going to see that fair elections are conducted. You tell me what to do for fair elections, and you please don't contest. Maybe I think about it. But I really think that the best way forward for Pakistan is that he should accept the fact that I am the front runner for the next October elections and work out a political settlement with the front runner. I know there has to be a transition. I know he's sitting in place, but I think he needs to have political accommodation rather than dictation.
Your Pakistan People's Party fared well in local elections this year. You say you're the front runner. What's the evidence of that?
Well, the local elections were held, and my party emerged as the single largest party in that, despite the fact that they were held on a non-party basis and we couldn't fight with our election symbol, and it was difficult for voters to recognize our candidates as a consequence, but we still emerged as the single largest party. And a recent study by an independent NGO called the Patton NGO found that we would win with 38% of the vote and that the runner-up would be Nawaz Sharif at 20% of the vote, and General Musharraf would come after that with 9% of the vote. So these are independent studies that are clearly showing that the people of Pakistan want the return of the Pakistan People's Party and myself. And I think they want that because the people of Pakistan are fed up of the tension that has taken place. Since my overthrow, we've had fighting with India over Kargil. We keep having some point of tension with India or another. We've had the Taliban rise up in Afghanistan. We've had the impact of terrorism in our own country. So I think people yearn for the stability that the PPP can give.
And this, in spite of your long struggles with corruption charges, you were convicted in a kickback scheme that was ultimately overturned, but this the legal wrangling has gone on, and you're essentially still subject to arrest in Pakistan, are you not, if you were to return there today?
I would be subject to arrest only if General Musharraf ordered it. Otherwise, I would be free to contest the election. I'll give you an example. My husband was bailed out last week from court, and General Musharraf ordered that he be arrested again. We've got 13 bail orders from the court, but we can't be free until the general politically decides that we are to be free. On the other hand, there's a drug smuggler by the name of Ayub Afridi who's been convicted by the court. He was freed. There are other political leaders who've been convicted by the court, and their convictions were set aside. So I'm telling General Musharraf, look, we need institutions. We need an independent judiciary. Please stop this persecution because it's only going to destabilize Pakistan. And today Pakistan is pivotal to a much larger global security issue.
Your husband, Asif Ali Zardari, has been in prison for 8 of the 14 years of your marriage, again on corruption charges. I guess your sense from the polls is that the Pakistani people are looking beyond these charges when they consider your political future?
Yes, I think that people in Pakistan look at these corruption charges as politically motivated. They look at the double standards, they look at the special court and the special laws. And I'm very grateful to the United States Department on Human Rights, which was the first one, I think in 97 or 98, several years back, that noted that some of these actions were politically motivated. I know that there must have been some corruption, and we need strong anti-corruption laws. But it's wrong to smear political opponents with unsubstantiated charges.
For the record, have you denied all these charges? There were convictions at one point, but are you and your husband both claiming complete innocence?
We have denied the charges. I have denied the charges. And when this conviction was made, I denied it then. I said I did not get a fair trial. Two American chief justices gave an opinion. They said that my trial was redolent of bias. It is their word. Redolent of bias.
Mm-hmm.
Nonetheless, it was only when an official of Pakistan released tape-recorded conversations between judges and cabinet ministers did the larger world community realize that I had been framed and that I was a victim of state-sponsored perversion of justice. The Supreme Court then set aside my conviction. And I have not only denied the charges, but have asked that there should be a Truth and Reconciliation Commission so that the charge that we have made of perverting justice can be examined, not for revenge, but just so that others in the future do not have to suffer in the way that we had to suffer. And I've also said, let's all sit down together and change business practices. There may be business practices that are legal, but immoral according to the standards of a more transparent society.
Mm-hmm.
I think that needs to be done. I think that that is a separate issue from politically motivated charges that we have denied.
And finally, the United States, on this front, the United States has often been friendly with authoritarian regimes in the Middle East that were not democratic, especially in times of crisis. Are you confident that the U.S. will loosen its relationship with General Musharraf enough to push for these elections wherein you might run?
There is so much at stake here. It's not just the future of Pakistan, but of the Muslim world and the much larger world community. America was attacked, and it was attacked from one of Pakistan's neighbors. It was attacked by people, many of whom had links with religious schools in my own country. So there are much larger issues. And at the end of the day, I think the Bush administration has to sit down and do a tally that did change in Afghanistan come through actions of Pakistan, or did change in Afghanistan come because of General Dostum in the north? And it's also got to think that did we get the intelligence support that enabled us to capture bin Laden and his key aides, or Mullah Omar, or did they manage to escape? And I think at the bottom of the line, the United States, I hope, will decide in favor of democracy, because in my view, democracies do not make war, and those that do not make war do not need terrorists.
And what about the popularity of the Taliban inside Pakistan, even in Pakistan's military before 9/11?
You see, the Pakistani military worked very closely with the Mujahideen during the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And so these people developed very close ties. And then they saw the Pakistan People's Party and myself as a threat to their whole vision of the world. They thought they defeated one superpower and they could defeat another superpower. They said this to me.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but we'll come back and talk more about that and about Pakistan's nuclear power. We have to take a short break. We're talking this evening with Benazir Bhutto, the former Prime Minister of Pakistan, chairperson of the Pakistan People's Party. She's contemplating, planning really, a new run for Prime Minister in Pakistan in October next year. She's with us this hour. You can join the conversation online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. This is Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight with Benazir Bhutto, former Prime Minister of Pakistan. Benazir Bhutto, we were talking just before the break about the popularity and the ties between the Taliban and the Pakistan military. You say these grew out of the Mujahideen era of resistance to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. This fall, we're told that generals who were especially sympathetic were taken out of power. But is there still a kind of sentiment in the halls of power in Pakistan that would support a more radical Islamic regime in Afghanistan that might be a threat to the new government that is the interim government in Afghanistan and hopefully democratic governments that might follow?
I do think that there are many people in key positions today who have sympathies for the radical Mujahideen and for their program. These are people who fought with Pakistan's former military dictator, General Zia, the Soviets in Afghanistan. Some of them have key posts. For example, the governor of Punjab was military secretary to General Zia's brother-in-law. The brother-in-law was posted in Balochistan, where the Afghan refugees were, where the Mujahideen were, where the schools were. So in that sense, there were a number of people in high positions who continue to have sympathies with the Mujahideen. And I believe the Taliban are going to regroup. I think they're going to regroup, and they are going to want to destabilize the new government that has been formed. That is another reason why I think that a democratic change that enables the PPP to come to power can give stability. Other than that, I really see these people fighting on. They fought on since 1979. That's more than two decades. And they're not going to give up until they have to.
The Islamic schools in Pakistan have been cited as a real breeding ground for the kind of radical fundamentalism and anti-American sentiment that fueled the Taliban. What's the status of those schools? What brought them to such prominence, and are they a permanent fixture of Pakistan at this point?
These schools were set up during the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, and they remained secret. Then when I was Prime Minister of Pakistan, at the American request, we arrested a man called Ramzi Youssef, who had done the first World Trade Center bombings in the 90s. Mm-hmm. During our interrogation of him, we learned about these schools. And then my government shut down one of the schools in Peshawar and put the others on notice that unless they changed their curriculum, they would be shut down too. And the schools went very much on the defensive, and they started changing their curriculum. But after our overthrow, they reemerged publicly as they were in the past. And now they produced public militias that would hold press conferences in Pakistan's important cities, declaring their dedication to bringing about an Islamic order. General Musharraf has said for the last 3 years that he's going to shut down these schools, he's going to regulate them, but he still has to deliver. So I really think as far as these schools are concerned, they have a vested interest in towing the government's line. They can't afford to sack their teachers or send home the students. And the government really should get tough with them. If they get tough with them, they can make a change.
But is public opinion in Pakistan such at this point that even the government cannot close the schools down, that this has just become part of many Pakistanis' way of looking at the world?
That's a difficult question to answer because public opinion is divided. But in this divided public opinion, people are also looking for a lead towards the government. In my time, we gave the lead. We shut down the university in Peshawar that taught students violence and hatred. And once we shut it down, the other schools fell into line. There was no revolt. Nothing happened. I think this is exaggerated talk that the government cannot come down on these schools. Certainly, the religious parties will protest. We need to expect that they're going to protest. But the protests will be small. They will be containable, and ultimately they will die down.
Benazir Bhutto, let's talk for a moment about Pakistan's nuclear weapons. There's been a lot of concern this fall about whether or not they might ultimately fall into the hands of terrorists. There have been reports and arrests of senior nuclear scientists in Pakistan who were suspected of cooperating with the Taliban, even with Al-Qaeda. How secure is Pakistan's nuclear weaponry, and can the world count on it being kept down and not somehow getting out loose, free, and in the wrong hands?
Well, Islamabad thinks that the nuclear arsenal is safe and secure, but there's really a growing apprehension amongst the international community that if there was, say, an army coup d'etat and a violent takeover of the state, that these nuclear weapons could fall into the wrong hands. So I've been calling upon Islamabad to enter into a dialogue with the international community to see how we can protect our own core interests while at the same time giving assurance to the international community. I think it's insufficient for us to say the international community should be assured, but they're not going to be assured unless we can have a substantive dialogue on this issue. So I'd like to see that dialogue take place.
And stepping way back from that, there's been a lot of talk about Islam and the Muslim world this fall in the West, people trying to understand exactly what this part of the world is yearning for. You've said this evening that in fact, behind all the clerical front, there's a lot of yearning for liberty and freedom. But there's been another critique that says that somehow Islam itself is at odds with modernity and that there's a clash, even as Samuel Huntington says, perhaps a clash of civilizations here that is inevitable. Do you see Islam as at odds with modernity? And is some clash with the West now inevitable? And if not, how can we get out of this relationship where it looks like it has the feeling of a cultural clash?
Well, I think it's so important to have a dialogue between civilizations. I'm concerned that misinterpretation of Islam could lead to a backlash. If Muslims are discriminated or feel that they're going to be singled out, then it might really create the kind of clash that we are trying to avoid. And that's why my party has been talking about a dialogue between civilizations. For me, Islam is in conformity with modernity. Islam is part of the entire Judaic Christian message. Muslims recognize Abraham as a prophet. We recognize Jesus Christ as a prophet. There are many, many similarities between Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, and ultimately of all religions, because as far as I can see, all religions talk about the need of peace, and they talk about the need of helping people who are poor or needy, the widows and the orphans. So I think this dialogue between religions is very important. And I think it's very important for Muslim countries also to bring forth leaders who can talk about similarities in the Judaic, Christian, Muslim civilization. But I am concerned that there could be a backlash. And I do think that we, the Muslim countries, need to decide our future direction. And I'm trying to help do that in Pakistan. We just talked about the nuclear issue. Way back in 1998, my party said that we should sign the CTBT, the test ban, the comprehensive test ban treaty, unilaterally without waiting for India to do so, because we felt in doing that, we would seize the high moral ground. So there are leaders like myself, I'm sure, in many other countries who are yearning to see their nations join the global community. But for that, we need democracy, because we need a peaceful way in order to go to our people and to form government.
Benazir Bhutto, talk with us for a moment about women in Islam in general, and particularly in Afghanistan, where under the Taliban, the strictures on their lives were so severe, so strict. There's been a debate in the United States over whether or not America should stand up aggressively for the rights of women in Afghanistan in a kind of almost liberation move to accompany reconstruction there, or whether women's position there and what we saw under the Taliban was in part cultural and centuries old, and Americans had no business messing around with it. What's your view?
Well, I think that there cannot be any human rights unless there is women's rights. I think women's rights is very closely tied up to human rights, and I think that America must speak out for women's rights. My party was in touch with a group of ladies in over 60 countries, and all of us had demonstrations or we had meetings with the United Nations officials saying that Afghan women must be taken in the new Afghan government. And we were all very happy when that took place. I think our Afghan sisters need our moral and our political support, and we must give it to them. I think women are the ones that raise families, that bear children, that want policies of sustenance and nurturance. And if we invest in women, I think that's going to have a tremendous rippling effect in the whole society. I would also like to say that I'm a Muslim woman, and for me the greatest inspiration was the Islamic inspiration, where the Holy Prophet's wife was a working woman. Now, if the messenger of God had a wife who worked, why can't all Muslim women work? Taliban didn't let women work. It's tradition. It's taboos. It's men caught in the past who oppressed women, and women must be helped by other women.
Benazir Bhutto, your life has taken some unexpected turns. As we discussed earlier, your husband has spent many years in prison. You've wrestled with legal charges, seen upheaval. Your own father, of course, was executed after his leadership of Pakistan. The path of life is always strange and surprising, but is your life turning out at all as you expected?
Well, one should always expect life to be unexpected. I was a student at Harvard. I got self-confidence there. I saw the power of my colleagues and American citizens changing their government. It was the time when President Nixon was being impeached. And I saw the power of individuals. I saw the creativity of individuals. And I wanted so much to see that kind of freedom in my own country. I've had a very long struggle, but I do see changes in Pakistan. I see that our journalists are not prepared today to accept the strictures that they were prepared to accept the day before. I see that more and more women in Pakistan now want education, and that those who can afford it send their daughters abroad for education when in the past they were less likely to do it. And now I see that my own government, which turned a blind eye to the forces of terrorism, is actually speaking about taking on the forces of terrorism. So the progress may have been small, but I think that progress has been made, although the price is very high.
Benazir Bhutto, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Benazir Bhutto is former Prime Minister of Pakistan, chairperson of the Pakistan People's Party, planning a new run for the Prime Minister's seat in Pakistan in the autumn of 2002. You can continue this conversation online at wbur.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. Since September 11th, many people have spoken about having a changed perspective on their lives or about shifted priorities. In this season of gifts and gatherings and reflection, we asked holiday shoppers at a local mall whether the events of the last months have changed what presents they are choosing to buy this Christmas.
Well, I'm thinking of buying gifts with thought and heart, but maybe not the same amount of price tag. It just seems superfluous right now. So for my two brothers, who I often get a sweater for, a new shirt, instead I went to an open house of some ceramic artists and found some really beautiful bowl for each of them. And I thought, well, this makes sense. It's a lifetime gift. It helps support artists. So it's just not from mall land, so... Sorry, Mr. Bush.
I'm shopping a lot differently because I could be losing my job next week or last week or the week before or the week after that. So we decided to only buy one present per person, and each member of the family chose one person, and we decided to stay to a small budget. I think we've cut down by at least 75%.
I'm shopping different this season since September 11th and trying to focus more on doing for others. And so I'm doing my family at the last minute, just trying to basically look out for people that normally wouldn't have a Christmas if people didn't try to make it happen, you know, for them. So I've emphasized on my son and my husband that, you know, we're not going to do a lot of gifts this year. We just want to get together with family and friends. And I'm just out at the last minute, just wanting to put a little something under my tree. I'm just grateful to have life, that's all.
Voices of Christmas shoppers in Watertown, Massachusetts.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas.
Listeners, we'd like your help. In an upcoming show, we're going to be sharing some of the songs that have helped people get through these past few months. What songs have struck a chord with you? Whether it's a holiday favorite or Billie Holiday, a Bach cello suite, Sweet Honey in the Rock, or Kid Rock, tell us about it. Send an email to special at wbur.org or call our hotline at 617-358-0062. That's 617-358-0062. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.